So there's several new people in the room tonight, and I might just say a little bit about what this is. It's called a Teisho. It's a Zen talk. Hopefully, it's not particularly intellectual. It's not something I prepare very much for. I sometimes think about it during the day, like what I might like to say. I might even pull out a particular quote or a koan. Koans are these teaching statements that are utilized in Zen training as a specific meditation topics that we look deeply into. So sometimes those are presented. Oftentimes it just comes out on its own. I don't really know where it's going to go. But I bring it out from the zazen that we just did all together, so from the same space. And so we'll see how this evolves. As much as you try to plan anything or control anything, you only have a very limited amount of control when you really see that clearly. It seems that we're choosing things. It seems like we're the masters of our own destiny. But if you really look clearly at it, this is all one big fabric of what has been called space-time that goes according to natural law. And in Buddhism, the term for natural law is karma, meaning cause and effect. So by the time something is present here, for example, what I'm saying, or how it's striking you, the sound of the fan of the air conditioner in the room, the smell of the incense, all the things that led to this precise configuration, just as it is, have spread through the universe to here, to this point, have spread. Scientists say, and I totally believe it, that there's conservation of information. So you've heard about conservation of matter and energy. Physicists also say there's conservation of information. In other words, what is the form of the world, meaning the sounds, taste, touch, sensations, thoughts, realities, interactions, emotions, everything that you can possibly experience, has its connections to everything throughout the universe, and that information is spreading outward from each center. It doesn't just stay there. It spreads, and it takes time. Nothing can go faster than the speed of light. So things spread gradually. When I say gradually, I mean in our short distances, it's almost instantaneous, but not instantaneous. But if you look at the grand scheme of this entire fabric of space-time, an analogy I like to use is if in our present moment right now the sun went out, went dark, that would have happened in the sun's present moment 8 minutes and 20 seconds ago. And the whole universe is like that. So this information spreads throughout the universe. So I may think that I'm somehow the captain of my fate right here and I'm producing this Teisho and it's something coming from me alone. But that would be a real delusion for me to hold on to that notion. It's a useful notion. It works in most situations. But when you really look closely at it, it just isn't true. It falls flat. So this situation that we're in now, we're beginning to understand that it's interconnected with everything in the universe. Now we said space-time, so things spread throughout space gradually, not instantaneously. Therefore, if something happens somewhere else, it is inevitable that it will eventually affect this point, and there's nothing that I can do about it or you can do about it. In other words, it's a done deal. The way the British put it, it's done and dusted. I like that statement. It's done and dusted. The sun went out. It's done and dusted. I may not like it. I may think it's a terrible fate. I may say, why me? but it's done and dusted. But we live our lives oftentimes picking and choosing, struggling against the way things are, even though they are truly inevitable. The way things are right now is inevitable. But we pick and choose between the way it ought to be, the way I like it, the way I don't like it. We continually try to create this perfect situation, which is okay. It's the human reaction. It's the way we've survived. But if it is held onto too tightly, if it is held onto with the delusion that somehow I have control, somehow I can totally pick and choose, and if bad things happen, it shouldn't have been that way, then I am unnecessarily creating suffering. Suffering. So Buddhism starts with that reality. That is actually the most fundamental teaching in Buddhism, that this kind of approach to our lives is dukkha, suffering. And the practice is, to a very large degree, seeing that very clearly and moving into a new relationship with the way things are, so that we're no longer doing battle with what was inevitably so in this moment, because it gradually spread, information is conserved, it's gradually spread throughout space-time. By the time that information hits my center of the universe, it's done and dusted. Why don't I save the energy of fighting it and opposing it and reacting to it unnecessarily? And maybe instead practice allowing it. Allowing it in the space of my awareness, which is my definition for the word embracing. So rather than reacting, fighting, clinging, rejecting, trying to hold on to something, make it not go away, trying to push away an inevitable piece of information coming from the entire fabric, what if I were to do something radical? What if I were to allow it allow? Now, what does this mean, to allow? It means to be mindful of it, to be aware of it. Allowing something in the space of my awareness. Isn't that what we are all just doing for 2 25-minute sessions? That is precisely what we were doing. We were learning how to allow. With our mind and body, not as a concept, not even as a method, so to speak, although there is a method to it, but entering it completely, fully, with my mind and body, my whole heart, deeply entering that state. And in my particular experience, over the 40 years, somehow I luckily stumbled upon this practice when I was 19. I've done that over and over and over, as most people in this room have, many people in this room have. We've entered that space over and over, intentionally, in all awareness and all alertness, entering the space of allowing the information that is inevitably present in this moment to be there in my awareness, without any fighting, without any complaining, very clearly. This is the beginning of what can be called dispassion. So it's the opposite of passion, reacting, reflex, habitual grabbing onto, chasing after. This Thursday, I'm a physician, some of you know that. I learned how to prescribe a medication called Suboxone. It's used for opiate addicts, and I'm starting this Thursday in a clinic. I'll be working with opiate addicts. And if you think about it, if you were to really push this clinging onto just the positive, trying to get rid of anything that is negative, painful, difficult, stressful, just holding on to the positive. If you really were to perfect that, you probably, if you were unlucky and encountered the wrong drugs, would be an opiate addict. You would be trying to get just the head side of the coin. and not getting the tail at all. And we all know what happens when you do that. You cut yourself off from your real life. You create immense suffering. You become paralyzed. In other words, the effort to always be happy, always be enlightened, always avoid pain, suffering, fear, depression, anxiety, stress, is its own kind of suffering, and it's probably a way worse kind of suffering. Let me read you a little something here. This is from a Zen teacher, and a student of mine sent me an email today. And she said, this is this particular author, I guess this person has written some books. Her name is Joan Tollefson. I've heard of her, but I never read anything by her. She actually was a student back in Bard College many years ago of many of our, for the new people here, many of our former teacher who died last year, Roshi Richard Clark, who was my teacher for 30 years and allowed me to begin teaching. But he was a teacher at Bard College. He was a professor there, and she was a student of his and mentions it in one of her books. But let me read this to you. So this is from one of her books. She said, and I think she was saying this in relationship to being a Zen student, and the danger in this particular practice, as in anything, like seeking after a high from a medication, an opiate, an oxycodone, whatever it might be, or trying to make as much money as you possibly can so that you'll never, ever suffer want, or any other type of addictive process, which is the mark of the human condition. In Zen, it is possible to continually try to maintain this state of balanced awareness, enlightenment, endless happiness, never ever feel any pain, any depression, any anger, and create a deep suffering over that constant fighting the natural ups and downs of every minute of your life. So here's what she wrote. She wrote, trying to be in any particular experiential state all the time is suffering, like a firefly wanting to have its light on all the time. It doesn't work. Instead of focusing primarily on the difference between one experience and another, we begin to notice what is the same in every experience. So she's talking about when we do this practice, this embracing, intent, plunging into the present moment, allowing with mindful awareness, choiceless awareness, as best we can, we begin to notice what is the same in every different experience. This is very, very important. Whether it is a contracted experience or an expanded experience, whether there's thinking or no thinking, whether we are washing the dishes mindfully or doing them on autopilot, whether we are watching TV or sitting in meditation, the beingness, the here-ness, okay, she's talking now about what this sameness is. So here she writes, the beingness, the here-ness, the now-ness, and this is a beautiful term in Buddhism, the suchness, such a subtle term, the suchness, the as-it-is-ness of each and everything, whether we like it or don't like it, whether it's painful or pleasurable, whether it's distracted or focused, whether it's despairing and fearful, or happy and open-hearted, the suchness is ever-present, like the water in every wave. Sometimes what we think of as enlightenment shows up here and now. And sometimes what we think of delusion shows up, and we begin to realize that there is no owner of either one of these appearances. They are impersonal, interdependent aspects of one undivided whole. Boundless unicity includes both enlightenment and delusion. Enlightenment recognizes that everything is the, capitalized, holy reality, even delusion. Whereas delusion seeks the holy reality out there, and imagines that this isn't it. This constant feeling like I'm lacking something. Maybe if I do enough zazen, maybe if I find this new Zen teacher in Northampton, I'm going to get enlightenment and I'll finally be made whole and get rid of this terrible lack inside. Delusion takes everything that happens personally. Enlightenment sees that nothing is personal. Enlightenment loves everything unconditionally and sees only God everywhere, while delusion sees enemies and obstructions, things that need to be vanquished and eliminated. There is nothing that is not unicity. Enlightenment recognizes that there is no enlightenment without delusion, that enlightenment and delusion arise together, while delusion is at war with delusion. So delusion is basically fighting, struggling, rejecting. And that arises. This is very, very important. And that arises. No matter what we do, it arises. It's part of the human condition. And when it arises, we also stay open to that. We also open a space. We also embrace, meaning allow that in the sunshine of awareness. The moment you allow rejection in the sunshine of your awareness, you have neutralized the rejection. You're not rejecting the rejection. You're becoming the embracing. It's very strange. When you fight the rejection, you get into the vicious circle of rejecting the rejection, despairing the despair, fearing the fear. We all know these states. Because of our Zazen training, and because, and I mentioned this to some of the new folks here, a critical aspect of this Zazen training is learning to focus the mind, meaning learning to be in this present moment with things exactly as they are in the space of awareness, holding on to a single focal point so that thoughts, which are very sticky, can begin to pass through rather than stay there and get stuck there. And in this process, we develop something called Jodaki, which is this powerful healing force. So we are learning to do this, to undermine, pull the rug out from under, neutralize the habitual reflex reactions, including clinging to things we want even though we know they're temporary, and chronically rejecting painful things because we think either that we don't deserve them or that it means that there's something bad about us, wrong with us. So this is changing that through embracing. You start with where you are. That's very, very important. Because each and every single thing is carrying this suchness, this thusness, this here and nowness. Something very remarkable, something deeply mysterious. We don't know where it came from, but we know it was always here. During the singularity before the Big Bang, there was something. There was I am. In the Bible, God said his name was I am that I am. There was this suchness, this beingness, this presence. And for whatever reason, it spread out into colors, sounds, smells, feelings, emotions, delusions. Takes all these different forms. This suchness is the water. And all these things are the waves coming off the ocean, temporarily. Coming up, having their moment in the sunshine of your awareness, falling back into the ocean, fading away. Because everything is temporary. So, I'm saying it, and Joan Tolleson said it in a certain way, but I'm going to read it to you now in a different way. Sometimes poetry says it so much better than any of these intellectual words. So, this is a poem, actually, that I encountered a couple of days ago. My daughter pointed me in the direction of this poem. My daughter's a wonderful person. We're just so close. So Becky said, Dad, have you ever seen that poem by Rumi? It's called The Guest House. And I read it. I go, Becky, I've got to present this poem at the next Tay Show. So here it is. And I'll close the Tay Show with this poem. All right, so this is Rumi. And Rumi, incidentally, was a Persian. He was from Iran. He was a Sufi. which is a Gnostic branch of Islam. It's actually in many ways similar to what we're doing here. It's similar to Zen. So he was a Sufi and a wonderful poet. Now, he lived around the year 1200, which was around the time of a very, very famous Zen master named Dogen. They were from the same era. So this is called the guest house. This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all. Even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice. Meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whatever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. So we'll end there tonight.